Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and it is Saturday, July 7th, 2012. And I've just arrived back from my van trip across Canada from Ottawa to British Columbia and back. And I've just had a long drive the last few days. But I figured I had to get back because I have so much work to do now. Including preparing my submission for this 9/11 body of evidences that is being gathered by Alfred Weber, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. So it was a beautiful country. Just seeing all the different types of mountains and hills and the prairies and. Seeing across the country, it's a beautiful country. Hardly any kind of garbage and such gathered along the highways. Generally, like the countrysides are so clean, and it was interesting. I'm going to talk next week. The next show we have is going to be all about chemtrails and chemtrail activism in Canada, and some things we're going to do along that line. Because that was one of the things I tried to observe in my travels, is looking at the chemtrails. So I would like to thank those people out in Vancouver, particularly Tony and Saria, who hosted me and put me up and let me stay there so I could take part in the Vancouver Walk for Peace. Instead of a peace march, it's a walk for peace. And so that was a nice event downtown and walk on the heart of Vancouver and speeches and music and such. Several thousand people at that. So it was a special event in Vancouver. So beautiful country, and it was an adventure for me to go to the 9/11 conference and then at the same time to take that time and travel across the country. Didn't set my tent up, but when I arrived home, I finally set my tent up again here in the backyard so I can camp out here at home. When I was traveling, I generally just slept in the van or stayed with people. But anyway, it was quite an adventure. So I'm going to bring Dee on. Hi, Dee. How are you?
I'm well, Christopher. I'm glad you had a great trip. I know we're going to hear a lot more about that as time goes on, as you hit the different topics like chemtrails. And I found it particularly interesting to that effect that on Canada Day, last Sunday, I went down to a local park where every year, for many, many years, they've held a Canada Day celebration. I used to be on the board of that committee producing that event. And I went down there, and one of the things that I noticed in particular was that the clouds all looked normal. And the sky was a bright blue, and there wasn't a trail in sight anywhere.
Yeah,
And in the meantime, what really got me upset, and I don't want to hear from a whole lot of people telling me that I'm discriminatory here, but I was really upset that the Canada Day events were not that well attended, because downtown at the same time as the Canada Day events were going on was this massive Pride Parade.
Oh.
And there were like a million people at the Pride Parade watching body parts being flapped all over the place.
Wow.
And feathers and God knows what. That was a bigger show than the country that you just described, going down the turlet in flames while we celebrate a birthday that really isn't a birthday, because we're not the same country that was birthed in 1867. It's nothing like it. And, you know, this really brought home to me a lot of stuff.
Wow, what a powerful image, Dee, that you draw. Like, that's where it's at. And even the Pride Parade would be put on the same day. That's to try to undermine Canada Day.
Exactly.
To take the significance and divide people.
It's disrespectful of the nation as far as
I'm
concerned.
Yeah, I agree.
In the first place, if there was a straight Pride Parade, they'd call everybody in it discriminatory racist or some yeah. such epithet. And, you know, in the meantime, they get away with this, 3% of the population, and now they go one step farther and take our national birthday.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? This is just getting a little bit silly. This is just getting a little bit silly, because we either have a country that we should celebrate or we don't. Which is it?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's much to celebrate now. I think Canada is based on such lies and public deception. You know,
well, I remember the last show that we did, Christopher, you mentioned something very, very appropriate. What you said was that people would be sitting in front of their TVs watching reality shows or watching football games or hockey. In other words, a bunch of men chasing balls around.
Yeah, yeah, you said
it's more important.
Yeah.
Is
yeah.
more important than 911 knowing who did what to whom and how this whole thing opened up as a generally a global takeover.
Yeah, and how they and how at the same time they're being sprayed with neurotoxins from the sky.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you start to look at these dots, and it's like, holy smokes!
I know.
Is there anything left here to count on?
It's so over the top. It's so,
yeah, it's unbelievable.
It's so audacious. It's so.
Well, you know, like Hitler said, the bigger the lie, the easier it is to put it over on them.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's basically how it's worked. And I see these people out there, and the reason they can't let go of that paradigm of thought that says, oh, it's all okay, don't worry, be happy.
Yeah.
Well, these guys playing Bobby McFerrin, for God's sake. And what do? They refuse to look because they're so afraid of what might be on the other side of that. They have nothing to rely on. So they'd rather deal with the devil they know and say, oh, well, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And holy crap, you know, the way it is right now is scary.
Yeah, yeah, we have serious troubles. It's quite terrible.
You know
it's
what
atrocious.
I just read today? I'm laughing. The state of Utah is now sponsoring some kind of a contest. Okay, they want to get a load of this: 10,000 registered home gardens. Okay, they want people registering as food producers. Even if you have a couple of rows of carrots and corn and potatoes and squash in your backyard, you're supposed to register as a food producer. And really what they're going to do is they're finding out by this, of course, notice it's a competition. So the people who register are going to be the ones who are proudest of their great big gardens, aren't they?
Yeah.
Right? So all these people who have good big gardens growing in their backyard, all organic, all healthy food, now they're registered with the government because, hey, I'm going to win a prize. Okay? So they're going after this prize, and they're not realizing that it's bait.
And
now that they're registered, the minute there's a food crash, and this is exactly how they're trying to control the population now is through food. It's the best way, you know, and this is where it's going. So, I mean, when you see that everything really, it didn't start with 911, but it made its presentation to the world with 911.
Yeah, I've always felt it was the evidences and event which would bring them down, because it shows you the massiveness of the deception and the
huge.
Dishonesty and the wars based on lies.
Huge.
It's horrible.
Huge.
It's horrible.
Yeah. And Jim Fetzer is now with us.
Professor,
how are you today, Professor?
Great. We had a little trouble with our connection because I'm not at home. I'm out in the country.
Ah, okay. That's why you kind of sound like you're kind of swimming underwater.
Well, probably does, yes.
That's okay. We hear you.
So maybe, Jim, we'll just let you start off. Why don't you give a summary a little bit of the conference and then some of the subsequent things that have come up to the conference and wherever you'd like to start.
Well, the conference was designed as a complement to the Toronto hearings, which had principally focused on the destruction of the Twin Towers, but which had not considered a wide range of theories about how it was done. We began with another neglected area, namely what did or did not happen at the Pentagon. We had three speakers, Enver Masood, who is an engineer and who was actually in the vicinity, he lives near the Pentagon, who walked over a hill to observe no indications of any plane present there. Barbara Honegger, who has a long history as a journalist for military publications and who also confirmed that no Boeing 757 had hit the building, although she believes there are indications of the possible use of a Global Hawk to fire a missile toward the building. And then Dean Hartwell, who was addressing, you know, what may have happened to the passengers, but where there's a tremendous amount of evidence that these were phantom flights, that 11 and 77 were not even in the air that day, and that the planes, where the planes corresponding to flights 93 and 175 were not even formally taken out of service by the FAA until 28 September 2005, which raises the questions, how can planes that were not in the air have crashed on 9/11? And how can planes that crashed on 9/11 have still been in the air 4 years later, where he believes that Flight 93 may have landed in Cleveland and offloaded passengers there at a distant airport, as was related on an ABC News report featuring the mayor of Cleveland, who mentioned Flight 93 by name, and where there were, for some period of time, photographs of alleged victims of the crashes. But when it was observed that the bodies were intact, those were taken down because these alleged crashes were all so violent that no one could possibly have remained physically intact as a consequence. That was Friday evening. Then Saturday morning and afternoon, we had two sessions that were devoted to different accounts of how the Twin Towers may have been destroyed, preceded, however, by a transition with Nicholas Kohlerstrom from the University, from the United Kingdom, who was actually also talking about the Flight 175 and research that suggests that what was used in New York was a hologram, where he was reporting on some recent research by a fellow named Richard Hall, who created a three-dimensional study of the major landmarks and did an analysis of the path of the plane seen in the photographs, to which I shall return. Then there were a series of five talks about how the Twin Towers may have been destroyed, emphasizing, first of all, by Chuck Baldwin, that the Twin Towers were designed in such a manner that they could not have collapsed, that it would have defied the laws of physics and of engineering, where Chuck made many quite stunning arguments, including, for example, the observation that because the steel tapers from being about 6 inches thick to the in the sub-basement up to about a quarter inch thick at the top, that the relative mass of the top... Yeah, go ahead.
We have Chuck coming on today for the second half of the show.
Yes, I think that's
Chuck,
wonderful.
Yeah,
with
yeah that's
14
good.
Floors represented only 1.4% of the mass.
Yeah, he had very good models of it. Yeah, sorry.
And that the idea that it could overcome the lower 98.6 is quite fantastic.
Yeah.
Plus, of course, as John Skilling observed, the buildings were designed with a safety factor of 20, which means every floor could support 20 times the number of floors it would be expected to support when they were occupied.
Yeah.
Then we had Jeff Prager's information, which was presented by Don Fox in substantiation of the use of nukes or mini-nukes, micro-nukes,
yeah,
based upon especially studies of dust samples and a wide range of elements that should not have been present, certainly not in the quantity they were then, from U.S. geological surveys that substantiates the use of nukes. Don Fox's own presentation, which further substantiates the use of nukes. Claire Kuhn came on to talk about some issues that may or may not remain where the possible involvement of directed energy weapons may be required to explain them, And then Duane Deeds offered a comparison.
It was interesting,
strongly supporting
Jim,
the use of mini nukes. Yeah, go ahead, Christopher.
It was interesting that the woman who had been in the CIA, who had been the liaison with the Iraqi government, and who was being set up in a way, but she reported that in the CIA, like through that summer, the story was that they were going to use thermonuclear bombs. Remember in her story, that corroborated then the evidence both that Chuck Baldwin shows, which were very excellent pictures of the kind of destruction of towers 6 and 5, which were kind of blown up from inside. They had completely just massive holes there, and then all the in the dust sample. So that was very significant. All of these are very significant areas of research, and it's just like all the lies come apart more and more.
The next session Saturday evening began with Susan Lindauer. As you observed, she confirmed many elements of what had already gone before and affirmed, possibly for the first time, her knowledge and belief that this had been an inside job that was made in the USA, in Webster Tarpley's memorable phrase, and offered, the insights of someone who'd been an asset for the CIA, which was quite fascinating. And then we had three quite remarkable presentations by Kevin Barrett, by Greg Felton, and by Joshua Blakeney, all of whom were substantiating that the 9/11 not only involved elements within the American government, especially the Department of Defense, especially the neocons, but that there had been complicity from the Israel by way of the Mossad. Well, I believe that the Likudnik origins of 9/11 have now been quite substantially documented. So that was one of the most important series of presentations in the conference. Though everyone, it seemed to me, made major contributions. And
yeah, it's
Sunday
kind of
morning,
the unspeakable to actually talk about it. Really, directly.
Say again, Christopher.
It's to say the unspeakable, to kind of directly talk about that like involvement of Israeli agents, at least in the perpetration of it, and who's kind of behind this in terms of the Zionist community. And
that's right. This was one of the major ways in which the Vancouver hearings were expanding the boundaries of 9/11 truth, because the involvement of Israel in this matter is something that has been taboo with virtually all 9/11 groups and previous conferences.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you never know. You say the wrong word about Israel these days, and the next thing you know, you've got somebody on your case saying you're some kind of an anti-Semite.
No doubt about it. In fact, Gordon Duff, who's the senior editor at Veterans Today, and Kevin Barrett, who is now a journalist there, and Alan Sabrowski, who was scheduled to speak but could not come, but who has been very outspoken about this. He had a physical ailment with his shoulder that made it impossible to participate. And I have all been cited by the Anti-Defamation League as anti-Semitic, even though, as I explained in an article of mine, is 9/11 research anti-Semitic, which they actually quote, that, criticizing the government of Israel or actions taken by the government of Israel or by the Mossad is not remotely anti-Semitic. Being anti-Semitic entails dismissing an individual or their worth on the basis of their religious or ethnic orientation, none of which is going on here. So the claim of anti-Semitism, although it's a powerful political club rhetorically, has no foundation in fact with regard to any of this discussion of indications of Israeli complicity in 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that situation is really getting ridiculous. And I thought it was rather interesting to read something about that kind of thing, that's an expansion of that, I'm just trying to find the note now. It's on realityzone.com today, like the latest issue from G. Edward Griffin. And essentially what they're basically saying is that if you are focused on individual rights, you are now considered to be a terrorist.
Wow.
You know, and they, I mean, they're putting stuff out about that. Here it is.
Wow.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security lists those who are reverend of individual liberty as right-wing terrorists. And this is from Infowars.com.
Wow, that's disgraceful.
That's unbelievably disgusting. And I also have reports today that Israeli operatives are going through the Internet and removing any information they find that can be viewed as anti-Israel. So I think we have a great deal to combat here, where they're trying to, you know, sanitize the Internet of evidence that shows...
What they do across the board, though, Jim, is if somebody says, wait a minute, you know, there's something wrong here, the first thing they do is try and demonize that person. So they do the same thing. When you mention Mossad connection with 911, they do the same connection. They try and demonize and discredit the person saying it, so that if you even open your mouth against it, you're automatically categorized that way. And this is how they're doing it in so many areas. Like even in the Pride Parade issue, oh my goodness, you're homophobic. You're a problem. If you don't agree that these people should do this or that, you're a problem. And this is the same thing they're doing with the gardening and with the healthcare and with everything. So in other words, if you're not part of the collective, right?
Yeah.
You're a problem to them. You are a terrorist.
Dissenters
are now equated to terrorists. So here we are sitting on the most sensitive issue to come out in Lord knows how long in human history.
Yeah, really.
And we're confronted with the demonization by those who would hide the truth.
Yeah.
I agree completely. It's outrageous, and it must be combated. We must put a stop to this. The American people, and indeed the world, are entitled to know the truth about these events, which are having such a profound effect on other nations, including most obviously Iraq and Afghanistan, but also Libya, Iran, and other nations yet. It's including, of course, Syria.
I
mean,
oh,
the
no,
situation
I know,
here
I know.
The use of NATO as an instrument of aggression for a Zionist foreign policy is completely wrong and despicable.
It is despicable.
It's
I mean,
tragic.
You know, I'm sorry for the Jewish people feeling, if they do, I don't know, I'm not Jewish, if they do, that they're put upon by accusations against their government. But, you know, we aren't the government. They aren't the government. Who did we lose?
It must be Jim.
Oh, dear.
Don or Doug in the studio.
We need to hang up and retry.
Okay, yeah. That's a heavy issue.
See, this is the thing. You can see that the method that they use goes across the board. And people need to get familiar with what they do and how they do it, so that when they're faced with issues like, how do I decide what I think and what I believe, right? You really have to understand that the disinformation pattern is always out there coming from the government, because they don't do anything without wanting the people to understand something else.
We'll come to some interesting stories, I hope, when we get Jim back on about some things that happened in regards to what you're saying. And disinformation articles that came out to the 9/11 community after the conference, which
they're all over the place. I mean, even this week I was watching as an activist who has been tossed out of Occupy Toronto and Occupy Vancouver because he's divisive and he harasses people. His name is Greg Renouf. Okay? He's online, if you Google Renouf, R-E-N-O-U-F, and quote in quotes, "This man is dangerous," you'll find all that information about what who he is and who's banned him and why.
Yeah.
This guy comes out against none other than Kevin Annett.
Oh, yeah.
Our former guest who came on to talk about the Aboriginal children and the genocide in this country by the church and state.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he comes out with that kind of stuff. Now you've got this guy attacking him directly all over the Internet. And I know Jim's been attacked, and he had death threats, didn't he, just over this conference.
And to think that these are kind of done by people like clandestine services within the police community itself. It's
these are our employees, people.
You know?
These are our employees.
Yeah.
These people work for us.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
they're doing this?
Yeah.
It's well,
that bothers me so much, the way they use provocateurs. You know, it like at that G20 in Toronto, it was absolutely disgraceful. They set up that whole black bloc
and
group.
Look at the Montanella.
They knew about them ahead of time, and it was all arranged with the media. That
of
the
course.
Media would, and then they kind of staged them smashing a bunch of things and burning a car, all kind of set up and staged. And they did it all. The idiots, you know?
Of course
it's so disgusting.
I saw the videos. There's the cops standing with their arms crossed and, you know, and standing back while squad cars are burning and there's no fire trucks, there's no emergency response. I'm going, hang on here. I don't care what you've been assigned to. When you got a gas-laden squad car sitting there waiting to blow up and a crowd of people around it, what do? You get the people out of the way, and you secure the area. That's what you do until the first responders arrive, which is the fire department. But none of that ever happened.
No, and they didn't arrest those people who were smashing the windows.
No.
Because they can't arrest the officers. You know?
Well,
remember what happened.
Remember what happened when they faked it at Montebello?
Yeah,
okay.
They could see their boots.
Yeah, they could see their boots because they faked
the same
being arrested
issue.
with the plastic handcuffs, and the whole nine was on the video, as well as the bottom of their shoes. And gee, wasn't it funny? The same shoes were on the officers as on the guys they were arresting.
I know.
My. How cute. But you see, we find out afterwards, which we all knew in advance, the Quebec Provincial Police had to admit it was their guys infiltrating.
Yeah, they
did.
Well,
if they did it at Montebello, what in your tiny mind would suggest that they're not going to do it again?
And they don't just infiltrate. Like, I was there that day in Montebello, and I saw those three guys. We were leaving at that time in the afternoon, and we saw them coming in. And they were, like, totally different than everybody else there. Like, other people there were, like, normal people and, you know, young people and old people and children and animals. And, you know, like,
Connie Fogel, who's not a young woman, and Maude Barlow, who's not a young woman, and grandparents in the crowd, and these same grandparents were confronting these officers and saying, "This is not your march. This is our march. Go away.
Yeah.
We don't want you here. Drop the rock. Take off the mask." All of that was on video.
Even passing by these guys, just the way they kind of walked along, like just big macho dudes, kind of
like
coming in.
They looked handle up their butt. Yeah.
They were totally out of place. Like they stuck out like a sore thumb. Like when I just saw, I thought, "Oh, here comes trouble," you know. And they're not infiltrating. They didn't infiltrate anything.
They just create
a scene, kind of, to try to justify police presence. And, well, you know, they're all such cowards, these police. Why don't they ever catch real terrorists
who do the real things going on, you know? I think what they should do is maybe emulate the police in Germany, who last week, when there was a march in, I'm not sure if it was Berlin or Cologne or something, but it was in Germany. At any rate, instead of these riot police lining the streets and threatening the crowd as they walked by, okay? What did they do? They took off their helmets and joined the crowd.
Wow.
And escorted them instead of restricting them.
Wow, that's so cool. That's
so cool. Yeah, it was really cool. It was really cool. And there's video online. You can search it on YouTube, and you'll find it. It is so impressive. And it's like Oath Keepers have come forward in the States. So all of these people who are part of, like they're on the lower end of the chain of command, these people who have been ordered to counter the people's resistance to things like, you know, the erosion of our rights and all of that stuff. Anytime the people are assembling, these people also have wives and husbands and fathers and mothers and children and some of them grandchildren who are on the other side of their line. They're on the other side. Now, do they really want to stand against their own families? This is one of the reasons why people like Henry Mackow have been saying for a long time they're breaking down the family. They're breaking down the family so that they can put these officers in a position where they will fire on their own family if they have to.
Yeah.
And you know what? I don't think that's going to work. I have more faith in these people as people.
Yeah, that's what I hope too. You know, that. But people, I don't think they see the situation they're in. They don't grasp it, and they don't.
Either that or they're naive enough to think that if they go along to get along, they will indeed get along. Well, I hate to tell them, they're only being used. I mean, come on, Henry Kissinger said it, right?
Yeah.
He said they're all cannon fodder.
Yeah.
Hello? I mean, what part of your being really dumb don't you get? You know what I mean?
And also, it's like I liked it in the old days in my life when the police were actually like police and they actually like caught the criminals and brought them to justice. And there was kind of like justice, you know, and that's what the police enforced the laws. But what we've seen in our society is a complete breakdown of that.
Yeah,
you know, we have the obvious kind of criminal elements who perpetrated these 9/11 and the lies and the wars and all these things, and they just get away with murder. They get away with anything, and the police don't do any of their job. You know, the CIA.
I read an article today, Christopher, that said that a lot of officers, a very very high percentage of officers who are involved as subjects of SIU investigations, don't comply with orders by SIU to hand over their notebook or be interviewed. Now, at this point in time, they have a right because they have a right not to incriminate themselves. But the notes, you know, I hate to say that, but your notes are a public piece of property because you're instructed to make them. And these guys are refusing to hand over their notes. So what? And these numbers are increasing. So that means that officers themselves are finding themselves in more and more compromising situations, and at the same time, they're feeling more and more threatened by the system they work in. So now you add all that up with what's going on out there, and their families being on the other side of the police line from where they're standing with their baton and their shield. And you've got a situation where the motivation is very strong. Remember, blood is thicker than government.
Yeah.
Blood is thicker than government. Stand for your family because nobody else is.
And I believe that the majority of people in the police services and intelligence and the military, I believe the majority of the people in those services, like, believe in ways and what they're doing and wanting to uphold justice and such. I think it's terrible what's been done to them in a way, like how these lies have been perpetrated.
I can remember, and this is a very long time ago, this is during the Vietnam War era, okay, but this is what was going on even then. You can imagine then what kind of magnification this little effort has had since the Vietnam era, which is, you were talking 40 years ago, okay? Well, my cousin was living with a young man who had come from Palo Alto, California, north of the border as a draft dodger, except that he was Canadian. And he had been taken down to California when he was 14 years old by his parents. And even though he was never an American citizen and never even applied, he had to register for the draft. Now, a friend of his went into the Army because of pressure from his family. And two others, including my cousin's boyfriend, decided they were going to enlist. They knew that they had a leave coming after basic training of 3 weeks, and they figured they could convince them by the end of basic training to get the hell out. Well, they did.
Christopher, I just got back in. I just figured out how to get you on the call-in.
Okay, great, good.
Let me finish this one sentence, if you would.
Okay.
He told me they got him out after basic training, but he said, and this is in the 70s, okay, he said that the entire process of basic training was designed to dehumanize every compassionate streak he had.
Yeah.
This is mind control.
Yeah, I think that's been traditional
on.
Kind of, yeah.
So this
part
is what these people have
training.
To break, okay?
Yeah.
Now, thank you, Jim, for coming back. We're glad to have
thanks.
You back.
I used to supervise recruit training in the Marine Corps. I mean, what they're doing is to get everyone to rather lose their individuality and their old habits in order to instill a new set of habits to conform to the conduct expected from military recruits. It can be described in a lot of different ways, but I mean, it has clear objectives that have to do with having, creating an effective military force. Although today, I'm very doubtful about the use that the United States has made of its military force. But would you like me to continue with this?
Yes, we ended, we had talked about evidences about the Israeli and the coup involvement, and why don't we go, you were kind of going through the conference a bit, so why don't you carry on a little bit from there? And
thanks, Christopher. Actually, we've come to Sunday morning when, Christopher, you yourself were the first speaker. I think you blew everyone away with a very large frame and study of the gap in the South Tower, which showed clear indications that it was manufactured. There was a series of steel beams that had been cut perfectly evenly horizontally. There was lots of steel beneath the parts of the facade that were missing. There were no indications of any parts of any aircraft there. I thought that was one of the most convincing presentations during the conference, and of course you added much more to it. Then we had Dennis Camino, who's very experienced with flight electronics and so forth, who explained that the flight data, recorder data, that the pilots for 9/11 Truth had obtained from the NTSB, which it claimed were from Flight 77, was manufactured data. It actually corresponded to a completely different approach of a plane that was 300 feet in the air on a due east trajectory, too high to hit any lampposts, a second from impact. It was 100 feet in the air, well above the Pentagon, as opposed to the barely skimming the ground acute northeast approach officially ascribed to Flight 77, which was taking out lampposts and performing feats that no real plane could perform. In fact, at 500 miles an hour, a Boeing 757 couldn't even get that close to the ground. It couldn't get closer than, say, a wing length. That plane has a wingspan of 125 feet. It couldn't have gotten closer than 60 feet to the ground. Could not have hit any lampposts. If it had hit any lampposts, they would have ripped the wing off of the plane. The fuel inside would have burst into flame. It would have cartwheeled, its tail broken off, created tremendous debris on the lawn, none of which took place.
No.
And then I concluded that session by explaining how all of the indications that all four of the crash sites were faked, including evidence from pilots for 9/11 Truth by the study of air-ground communications, which established that while Flight 93 was in the air on 9/11, it was over Champaign, Urbana. At the same time, it was supposed to be crashing in Shanksville.
And that while Flight
175 was
in Illinois?
Yeah. Right, Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. And that while Flight 175 was in the air, it was over Pittsburgh and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. At the time, it was supposed to be entering those buildings. And I gave ample additional proof that all these crash sites had been fabricated, which seems to me to be one of the most effective ways to pull the rug out from the official account. Because
yeah, well,
none of its claims
like
about
it's the same. It's the same thing as matching registered flight paths against chemtrails. You know, there it is. What are you going to do about it? Or have they actually mastered the art of being in the same place at the same time?
Ooh, I'm not sure.
Exactly,
at the same
I know.
Time. You know, I mean, obviously this is chicanery. Right. Obviously
yeah.
It's chicanery. So,
mm-hmm. That,
you know,
it's interesting that Jim has formulated this conclusion, and he sent one email around, and it was... Almost all the researchers there agree with the statement that each of the flights, like the one did not hit Shanksville, the Pentagon, or either of the towers, that people don't believe that any of those four commercial planes actually impacted at those sites. And a single researcher who disputes that. Is there, Jim, from that sequence of emails?
Not that I'm aware of, Christopher. I think we're all on board, and, you know, by a strict definition, that's the no-plane theory. It doesn't mean there were no planes involved anywhere.
No.
It appears that some plane may have, you know, been flown toward the Pentagon and then swerved over it. But
yeah.
Flight 11 did not hit the North Tower, that Flight 77 did not hit the Pentagon, that Flight 93 did not crash in Shanksville, and that Flight 175 did not hit the South Tower. And
yeah,
I don't know
I think,
of anyone.
There's a unanimity of agreement,
evidence,
I think, among the researchers concerning that those four were fabricated. And there's all different evidences
yeah.
for it, including, like, the documented flight registries and other evidences, and then the evidences from the impact sites, where none of the evidences of any large commercial planes were found at any of the four sites. So the whole fabrication of
what was found was obviously planted and contrived.
Mm-hmm.
For example, an engine component was found at the intersection of Church and Murray in New York City that allegedly had come from Flight 175.
Yeah.
But it was underneath a steel scaffolding. It was sitting on a concrete pavement that was undamaged. It wasn't even from a 767.
Which then is further evidence of the fabrication of the planes. Like, that is just further evidence of their complicity, the fact that there's this false evidence. I mean, yeah.
You're absolutely right, Christopher. And where Jack White even discovered Fox News footage showing a white van at that intersection where agents wearing FBI vests were unloading something heavy. I mean, this was clearly planted.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The gullible American public, you know, may have swallowed it up, but
yeah.
it's clear evidence, as you suggest,
well,
of the fabrication of that particular...
Jim, you know what they were told
crash.
Immediately after 911 by the smirking chimp who arrives on scene at Ground Zero and says, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. So guess what? They made an on-the-spot decision and swallowed the official story whole cloth.
Yeah, well, all the media had prepared people all the way along for that. You can see, like, when you go back and you look at the first coverage and how they come out with Osama bin Laden and the terrorists and that, it's so phony on all the TV networks.
Yeah, and you had
it's
to
so obviously
it or
staged.
You were automatically something that they didn't like.
Yeah. So, Jim, one of the interesting things subsequent to the conference has been the emergence of this document. It's called, can you say something about that as it ties into what we're just talking about? It's called the Dakota Report, is it, or something, which was supposed
yes,
to be
yes,
revealed
yes.
from an insider?
Yes, but I omitted the final session before
okay,
we turned
okay,
to that,
well,
Christopher, which was Sunday afternoon.
Okay,
where John McCarthy spoke. He's a former Army officer who worked with the CIA and was explaining why that the government should be complicit in 9/11 ought to come as no surprise. Then we had Webster Tarpley, who is very well known and who made a rather extraordinary denunciation of all the evidence that had been presented of Israeli complicity, which I think was the most aberrant or unusual aspect of the entire conference. And then finally,
and also
Anthony Hall is
one of the only researchers who still believes that there were airplanes. He said that among his comments.
I mean,
so he would be the one dissenting voice from what we had discussed earlier.
Yes. I don't want to suggest Webster's behind the learning curve, but I was very surprised by his statements. Then finally, Professor Anthony Hall from the University of Lethbridge, talked about in general about what's going on here in the world and the travesty of 9/11 and where it fits.
Yeah.
Now, the point you're making, Christopher, is that Barbara Honegger said to all of those of us who had participated in these so-called Dakota documents that were making a lot of claims as being official documents, and they do have some signs of being very cleverly contrived. But we had a brilliant critique of the Dakota documents by Dennis Camino, who is quite an expert in this area, who revealed that it was rubbish, that there are attempts to resurrect the idea that planes were actually used, and also that, you know, Israel had nothing to do with it and that 9/11 was committed by Saudi Arabians. I mean, if you want to talk about ridiculous rubbish, that's what we have in these Dakota documents, ridiculous rubbish.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh. Well, it was funny because in the first, I only read one of them. There were two of them, so I didn't know about them trying to shift it over to Saudi Arabia. But in the one I read, that was my impression. My impression was that they don't like it that people are beginning to suspect that the media played a role in staging this. And so that they wanted to reaffirm that, yes, you guys are right. None of the four commercial planes were used. And they described where they went and how they used these fake other planes and the planes that entered into the buildings in such an impossible way. They say it was because these were specialized planes, special alloys, and they had done something to the building so it could slip inside without there being signs of impact. So they want to hide what's coming out is the complicity of the media and the fakery involved in this photography and such. That was my impression of them, Jim.
And the thought just struck my mind, just briefly, the thought just struck my mind that, you know what, we can't really blame the younger generations for not catching on to all of this because they've never seen episodes of the Keystone Cops.
The Keystone Cops. Dennis has discerned multiple indications that these were documents that originated with the Mossad. So I think we have here further indication that we're on exactly the right track and that the major conclusions that emerged from the Vancouver hearings are actually right on the money.
Yeah, and the Democrats kind of go and confirm that, don't they?
Well, it certainly has taken everything a further step in putting together a criminal case, which is another exciting aspect of the conference and the subsequent work by Alfred Weber, putting a case together. I don't know if you want to discuss that at all, Jim?
Oh, certainly. I think it's very important because the hearings not only were intended to, you know, fill in all the gaps and round out our understanding of 9/11 by expanding the boundaries of 9/11 truth, but also to provide an opportunity by way of sworn presentation of evidence and sworn evidential submissions to fashion indictments against those the evidence implicates in the crime, which are then going to be submitted to the International Criminal Court. This will be the first 9/11 proceeding that has had that intention and that effect, which I compliment Alfred for doing a brilliant job of thinking all this through, and we're proceeding apace to get it all put together at the very same time, we're making available the presentations and PowerPoints from the Vancouver hearings at the Vancouver hearings website, which is www.911vancouverhearings.com. And if you go there and just click on the activated titles of presentations, you can get the material on which they were based, or in the case of Dennis Camino, you can actually hear his make his presentation, because that has been uploaded onto YouTube, where I hope many others will subsequently appear.
Yeah, that's excellent. I hope they try to get them all up there. I'd really like for mine to be up there with my videos edited into it and that. Having Alfred there, to me, I found it very moving when he kind of got people, stated their names, they raised their hand, and they swore to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. And we had that all through the conference. And I really thought that offset something. That was very significant to me when that was being done. It was moving in a way. And as you say, that's so good that Alfred is doing this to take this forward.
I agree completely, Christopher. I think he and Connie Fogel, our other judge, made an extraordinarily important contribution, and their value here is only beginning, because putting together these indictments is a massive undertaking, which they're approaching, I think, with great thoroughness and intelligence and dedication.
Yeah. That's why I had to come home from BC, because I got to put together my materials. I had to get home to start working.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to get an extension myself.
But it has been extended to 1 August already, Christopher.
Oh, it has. Oh, I didn't know that. That's good. Thanks. Yeah.
Yes.
Because I had it prepared, but then we all got to get it notarized and such to put it together as a criminal case. So, well, that's all very interesting. Boy, it must be quite something for you, Jim, to kind of put on a conference like this and go through everything you do to keep pursuing this. How's it been for you, and what's your next project, or where do you think you're going now?
Well, fairly exhausting. I mean, completing this project is my immediate plan, because we're working on the DVD, you know, working on getting the submissions, working on getting everyone's presentation somehow accessible to the public one way or another. So,
excellent.
You know, we have a lot of elements to tie together here to bring this to completion, but I can't imagine anything more important that I can be doing in my retirement, where my wife has observed that since 2006, when I retired after 35 years of college teaching, that I've been busier now than I was when I was teaching full-time.
Yeah. Well, that's I admire you so much, Jim, for doing it and putting your life at risk through your work and just doggedly pursuing the truth. And it was unfortunate that at the conference, it's like there was so much information and speakers and you know, I miss that we didn't have more time just to talk, and I hope someday we'll have a chance to talk more. And I think everybody found it was a demanding schedule, we ran over at times and things.
So there were lots of challenges, especially technical ones, that a different venue probably would have accommodated in a simpler fashion, but we had to deal with what we had when we showed up at the scene. That's one of the difficulties. When I organized the Madison Conference here in 2007, I was able to visit the hotel. I mean, I checked out multiple venues before selecting the right one, and I knew exactly what we had available, whereas in with the Denman Theater in Vancouver, I'm, you know, 3,000 or 2,500 miles away and had to depend on others to sort things out. And it may well be that they simply didn't know quite enough about what we needed to make it all work technically. But somehow we've managed, Christopher. We've made it through this far, and I believe what is yet to come is going to prove to be the most important part of our effort.
Yeah, absolutely, Jim, because all the researchers were there and all the materials were presented and the discussions and, you know, it just consolidates the evidences more and more. You know, I think it's the emphasis on how the towers were brought down by mini nukes. I think that at the most, at currently, is the most parsimonious explanation. Wouldn't you agree? Like, in terms of the law of parsimony, because, like, directed energy weapons, not to completely rule them out, but it was more than just thermite, because, I mean, there's that startling fact about the explosive power of those items cannot match what is required to kind of dustify the steel and concrete. So it's like direct evidence that's not enough to explain all the other unusual phenomena. And so it's really shifted now, I think, to mini nukes as a part of what was done on that day.
I think you're right, Christopher.
Sure.
I mean, the major findings that resulted were no Boeing 757 hit the Pentagon. That's quite stunning, given that's our nation's command and control center. To have a fabricated story about what happened at the Pentagon is revealing that the government was into this across the board. That you know, the Twin Towers were destroyed using some very sophisticated mechanisms that appear to have involved mini or micro nukes, which the government is also obfuscated by calling it a collapse, when a collapse wasn't even physically possible, tells us that those working for NIST were operating as part of a cover-up. They had to know better, because it wasn't even physically possible that those buildings should have collapsed. Then the evidence of Israeli or Mossad involvement in 9/11 is simply overwhelming and requires acknowledgement in general. And here again, the government obviously has been covering things up. And then when we realized that all four of those crash sites were fabricated, the two of the planes weren't even in the air that day, that the other two were far removed, and that very sophisticated methods of deception were used here, including planting evidence that clearly was not bona fide, where a piece of fuselage, for example, found on the lawn of the Pentagon has been traced back to a crash in Cali, Colombia in 1995, I mean, how bad can you get, Christopher?
I mean,
this was outrageous, and the American people are entitled to know the truth.
You just put all the evidences together, and there's an overwhelming mass of evidences that the whole story has been a fraud and a deception, and there's overwhelming evidence there. And it's amazing. That's been done in 11 years. Like, that's been put together, and there it was. You know, you have that overwhelming evidence was put together at that conference that, you know, we were deceived and that there's something wholly else going on.
I believe what you're saying, Christopher, is that we succeeded in expanding the boundaries of 9/11 truth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was a very important conference. I'm discouraged. I even heard reports that Richard Gage had kind of discouraged people from attending and Vancouver people from attending.
Well,
that's very upsetting.
But you know, not even the Toronto hearings acknowledge that nanothermite does not have the explosive capacity required to blow apart those buildings. I mean, Mark Hightower and I had published several articles about it, where he's a chemical engineer who discovered that the detonation velocity of nanothermite is only 895 meters per second. But to destroy concrete, to pulverize concrete, requires 3,200 meters per second. To decimate steel, 6,100 meters per second. So you can't get there from there. The myth of explosive nanothermite, I think, has done great damage to the movement and kept us from sorting out the real question here about how the Twin Towers were destroyed.
Yeah, and the term I learned from the conference that is most valuable to me was a limited holdout, and that's how I see that main emphasis on nanothermite. It's been a limited holdout that's tended to restrict looking into other phenomena as well, in terms of the mini nukes or directed energy weapons or how the towers were brought down. So it limited that, and they also kind of don't want to look at who's behind it. They're saying, oh, all we got to do is get the criminal evidence that this was done. So they limited that, and then they don't want to look at all of the these claims about there being no airplanes and that an airplane didn't fly into that hole. They kind of ostracize no-planers. And I'm a no-planer. I like that title.
It's quite a shocking, Christopher, when you look at the big picture, but I think we've finally overcome the obstacles that they have artificially imposed, and that we now see the big picture, the landscape of 9/11.
Yeah.
It's the old divide and conquer.
Yeah.
Divide
and conquer, yes.
Yep, that's exactly what
they did. Limited hangouts and this suppression and deception, yes, I'm sorry to say.
Well, I'm so glad it comes out. It always comes
out. I'm so glad you're having Chuck Baldwin on, because he's going to inform your audience of, a lot of very important elements about what happened in New York on 9/11.
Yeah, he had a very impressive presentation and some most interesting models of the building, which you just saw the impossibility. Like, it's just such basic Newtonian physics just makes it totally impossible. Yeah, it was a very, as well as his shots, I was particularly taken by the shots of Building 6, because I'd always have been puzzled by that. But before you go, Jim, there was one thing I wanted to ask you about, and I can't remember what it was. I'm glad we have a little bit longer to work at submitting our evidences, and I'm going to get down to that over the next couple of weeks. I'm pleased to know I want to do a good job with that.
I'm sure you will, Christopher. I think this may be one of the most important tasks any of us has ever undertaken in our lives.
Yeah. I have to try to put together what I can say and do about what my research shows. Yeah.
Yeah, my mommy didn't bring me up to be no activist either.
Yeah.
I'm sure she's rolling in her grave now, but you know what? Hey, Mom, that would be me.
Well, times have changed, you know. In the old days, when we had an honest government, it wasn't so important to be an activist. Today, when they're liars and thieves and cheaters and mass murderers, the situation is completely different.
Let me just correct you on one thing. We had a more honest government.
It's a relative judgment.
I agree completely.
Yeah. Now we realize how criminal they are, like the full extent of the criminality. It's terrible. It's so tragic. It's so tragic for the American people and all of us, you know, even the Israeli people. You know, I see them as subject to kind of a criminal government in the same way we all are, you know.
Yep.
Like people say sometimes, oh, Israel did it. Well, Israel didn't do it, you know. Like, the people of Israel have been deceived, too, and they're kind of facing this in their country.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like there's a unanimity among Israelis about this, you know.
No, I mean, come on. The geographical country did not do it.
No, okay? Exactly.
The people running the place did it.
Yeah, as agents, and then who's kind of really behind that? Because it's an international thing. It's an international problem.
I mean, we don't know exactly who was the hand that directed it all from above. You know, all these things are linked. You know, all these things are bigger and more complex than even we can see after studies for years.
Yeah,
you know, but you know, you get to the point where you realize that. It's almost every man for himself, and you got to know as much as you can generally in order to proceed. So it's incredible that certain people are willing to risk their lives, their reputations, their families' reputations, everything that they've got to bring the truth to the people.
And that's what our guest has done, Jim Fetzer, and I absolutely honor you for what you've done, Jim, and thank you for pursuing this so doggedly and searching out the truth like some profound philosopher armed with your...
Well, thank you. Thank you for those kind words, Christopher, and it's taken a lot of effort by a lot of people, including you and Chuck Baldwin, whom I'm so pleased you're featuring today as well.
Yeah, and I hear that Chuck's in the background, so we're going to be able to move to him. And and I hope someday, Jim, if you do another conference, you'll consider me again to present some of my further studies.
Yeah,
absolutely, Christopher. You could count on that.
Yeah,
great.
For our part, what we'll do on this end is continue to let the dogs out.
Yeah, we've been honored to have you on our show like 4 or 5 times over the last month, Jim. I really appreciate you doing that. I want to try to do something with that to put the material on in some form or something. Yeah.
Oh,
great. Okay, so
Christopher.
So we'll keep in touch, and someday you'll be back as a friend of the Zero Point Show.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jim.
My great pleasure, and you give my best to Chuck Baldwin.
Okay. Okay.
Thanks, Jim. Take care.
Yeah, it's quite something. It was a heavy conference. Like, it just kind of all coming together more and more. Wow, and I gather we have our next guest online. This is Charles Baldwin, and I think he goes by Chuck. Chuck, are you there?
No, I'm bringing him in now.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Okay. Our poor twin in the booth.
Yeah.
Yeah, for people who don't know.
Oh, I got someone knocking at my door. Hold on, you're gonna have to carry it for a moment.
Okay, I'll blather for a moment. Pastor Chuck Baldwin, I think a lot of people know, is a regular contributor at newswithviews.com and has been very outspoken on a number of issues, both constitutional and global issues. He's a very, very well-rounded in his knowledge, and he has a huge following across North America and around the world. He's run politically. He's done all kinds of amazing things. He recently relocated to a ranch out west, and I hope that he will
be. Your guest is with us.
Oh, great. Pastor Chuck Baldwin, are you there, sir?
I'm back. Did we get Chuck in?
I think you do. Are you there, Chuck?
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent.
Okay, Chuck.
Welcome.
We just had a very interesting hour with Jim, who gave an overview of the conference and what we've been doing subsequently. But yeah, you had a most impressive presentation and some very interesting models that kind of demonstrated the preposterous story we've been told about the collapse of the towers, and you also had some pictures of building 6 and 5 and such, which I hope you'll discuss. So I'll just turn it over to you, Charles, and where would you like to begin?
Okay, my particular type of presentation is kind of elementary scientific, and as far as just talking about like my posters and things that are semi-complicated, but if you see them, they're simple. So what I like to do is to allow all of your audience that's listening right now,
yep,
and that will be listening to the archives so that they can reach the presentation, which is in the form of a PDF. Actually, there's two of them. And I'm going to tell your audience right now what you need to type in to your browser simply is Chuck Baldwin's Vancouver presentation, and that is Chuck, C-H-U-C-K, and then a space, and then B-O-L-D-W-Y-N, apostrophe S, space, Vancouver, V-A-N-C-O-U-V-E-R, presentation, P-R-E-S-E-N-T-A-T-I-O-N. I'll say this one more time. Chuck Baldwin's Vancouver presentation. And that's C-H-U-C-K-B-O-L-D-W-Y-N apostrophe S, Vancouver, V-A-N-C-O-U-V-E-R, presentation, P-R-E-S-E-N-T-A-T-I-O-N. All right. What will come up is a few links here. It's down just a little bit, and you'll see it. should be very obvious. Chuck Baldwin's Vancouver presentation. Just click on that link, and you will go directly to Donald Fox's site, and they'll tell you Chuck Baldwin's Vancouver presentation. And you'll have two blue parts down in part one and part two. And when you click on part one, you'll go to my PDF presentation in full color. So you click on that, and then you can open up full screen. If you have a PDF reader, you might be able to view it there, but if you got a regular big screen, it shouldn't be a problem. And open that up wide, full screen, and you'll see the PDF there, which some of you may have slides over on the left-hand side. Give it a second to pull everything in. The first one is 41 slides. And
wow.
So I don't know if I'll be able to present the whole thing today. That started just a little bit late, but I'm going to try. And I had to hustle through this presentation also at the Vancouver hearings. So I'm waiting for this to come up here. Okay. The first slide, have you got your computer?
No, I don't. My internet was down today, and I'm not on it. Dee, do you?
No, actually, I don't either because
it's
an electrical storm here.
Yeah, I don't think it would be best, Chuck, to go through the slides so much as, I mean, why don't you try to get to summarize the major areas of presentation you gave, because there were a number of them, and I mean, in terms of your models that you presented at the conference, that was really valuable.
Everything I got is extremely, extremely visual. So not being visual handicaps all of you and the audience, too. I need to let you know that right now.
Yeah.
Anyway, I did send you an email about how I wanted to approach this. Perhaps you didn't have a chance to look at it.
Well, I just arrived home kind of was exhausted from traveling and such, so I wasn't fully prepared to. And I'll try to put your links up on my site when I have a time.
Well, all together, I've got something like 80 slides. And they're very, very simple, very colorful, and should be very clear, even for somebody, even for a middle schooler, should be able to follow this. It's pretty simple. The first slide I have just tells the whole story. This is a quantitative, which means numbers. It's not qualitative where you're just waving and jumping up and down with your arms. Qualitative, saying, yes, it's big, 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 and everybody's saying, well, how big is big, you know? Quantitative puts a number on it. So we're talking about very precise quantitative situation here, which makes it much more scientific and much more believable. The title of this is Vector Forces Physics and Mathematics Provide Direct Proof for the Impossible Collapses of the World Trade Center Twin Towers on 9/11. And at the presentation, I presented a couple models, and I don't have models here so that you can see them, and that's why this thing is so visual, to make the impression. What I do is I take a twin tower, and I break it up into seven cubes, 110 floors, approximately 16 floors per cube. And then we also have six floors in the basement, which is separate. So we've got
is that division inherent to the division, like you talked about the thickness of the steel as you went up the building, how wide it was at the base versus each segment was of a lesser?
Well, what I have is a statistical model. What I know for sure, over and over on the internet documented, is that the basement was 6 inches thick. And above the basement, the next section up where the trees were was 5-6 inches thick. And then it progressed up to 4 inches. And then as you get higher and higher, the changes, it may not be exactly four. It may be many, many more changes in thickness. There were something like 20 or 30 separate sections of columns. About every two or three stories, you had a column block. And some of them even have one. So what we have is 12-foot column, or a 24-foot column, or a 36-foot column. In the basements and all the way up, pretty high up, there were like 36, three floors each. Three floors. And as we go up, like I say, the first cube from the ground floor up 5 inches, and then the next cube, cube two, 4 inches, and then the next cube, 3 inches, next cube, two, the next cube, one, and then the sixth cube is a half inch, and then the final cube, which is the top 14 floors that is allegedly falling and crushing the bottom, is only a quarter inch thick. It's and if you count up all these quarter inch thicks, let's just say 6 inches in the basement. We're in how many quarter inches of steel make up 6 inches? Okay, 1 inch is 4 quarter inches, right?
Yeah, 24. Yeah.
So 6 inches would be 24. So the steel just alone in the basement was 24 times thicker than in the top section that's falling. Not only was it 24 times thicker, it's 24 times heavier, 24 times at least, probably much more than that supportive. So we're just talking about weight and mass, 24. Now go up to cube one. Cube one is 5 inches. That's 20 times thicker. And then the next one is 4 inches. That's 16 times thicker. The next one is 3 inches. So that's 12 times thicker.
Sorry, just a minute. Were you hearing that interference, D?
Yeah, I heard a little bit.
Oh, all of a sudden it cleared, which is good. Is D there? Oh, okay. Well, I'm not sure what's happened. Okay. Sorry. Okay. So, go ahead, Chuck.
Okay. Well, you can probably understand now how trying to describe my models and everything really is extraordinarily, super extraordinarily visual. Now, you got to imagine this in your head, which is much more difficult getting this information to people without being able to see it. Okay. So just think, 24 times thicker in the bottom, 20 times thicker the first cube, 16 times thicker the second cube, 12 times thicker the next one, 8 times thicker the next one, 4 times thicker, and then twice thick in the sixth, and then finally the quarter inch at the top. Now, the quarter inch at top makes one part quarter inch slab out of 72. So the weight of the top section that's falling is 1/72 of the steel column weight as compared to the bottom. That is to say, the steel in the columns is 72 times as massive and as heavy and as thick. 72 times the weight of the column supporting that last section. So if you see a model of this, it just blows your mind. I call it the convincer, and there's no government PhD that's going to get around this. All these guys, Bazant, Eager, Hamburger, Sunder, they're all full of crap. Now, here's the difference between the true model and the government model, which they just hushed up and they didn't tell you anything about. Or if they did, they did it in a sly way. What all their calculations for all these people that are lying, all these big-name scientists at all these big universities, all their calculations are based on a model that is uniform thickness. So by uniform thickness, I'm talking about where from the basement to the roof, which had equal thickness, which they think is about the Sunder, I believe, in the NIST report said something like maybe an inch, three-quarters of an inch to maybe an inch and a half, when it's really far, 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 far thicker than that at the bottom going all the way up.
Yeah.
And even for a uniform thickness twin tower, I figured out that it was still would not fall down. You would need something like 37 more. 30 with a safety factor of 5 for New York City, if you use the equal distribution model where the top is approximately 1/7 the weight, in an equal distribution model as compared to 170 seconds in an unequal distribution weight. Now, the difference is about 12% of the weight in the equal distribution model compared to about 1.4% in an unequal distribution model. Now, anybody that's out there knows anything about building tall structures knows that you don't make it all the same thickness. Because if you pick 1 inch thick, by the time you get up to the top, that thing's just going to be swaying.
Yeah, it would be top heavy. It would be terrible, yeah. Because it moved quite a bit. There was quite a bit of movement in strong winds, like 8 to 12 feet.
It would be like
a
flexible stick that you'd have, and you'd have huge swaying. If it was all 6 inches thick, it would probably be okay. But if you're talking like 3/4 of an inch all the way up, that thing would be so unstable, the wind would be flexing that thing back and forth maybe 15 or 20 feet. And it's 20 feet to the left, 20 feet to the right, maybe more, 30 or 40 feet. You know,
it would be interesting. When we think of the building, it's like those massive steel columns in the lower part of the building. They were already easily holding up the weight of what was above them anyway. Like, you know, even if it was like part of the top was falling on the next floors, I mean, it's still holding the same amount of weight from the beginning. I mean, it's so preposterous.
Yeah, for 30 some odd years.
When you look at your vector physics.
It only fell 12 feet. The top fort, I mean, it didn't really fall.
No.
It was cut, and then exploded out, and then it made to look like it fell. Okay, so when you take out all the support, it's going to fall because gravity says it's going to fall, because that's a force going downwards, constant force, constant gravity. Anybody that's an engineer or don't even have to be an engineer, just if you know anything about pyramids and any type of structures, the old structures, you know that even forts, that they always build the lowest section thick, really, really thick, and then as you go up, you don't have to have it as thick because it all depends on what's the weight above that area? So when you get way up to the 90-some-odd floor, you only got 10 or 15 more floors to put up there, so that it doesn't need to be that thick. You got a 110-story building. You need very, very impressively thick steel at the bottom, and it's going to progressively taper off. And any engineer worth any kind of anything, that's probably one of the first classes you learn, that when you build a tall structure, it's got to be tapered from thick and heavy, and much, 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 much stronger at the bottom, even at the halfway point. And you got minuscule weight at the top. So when you try to bamboozle the public and cut the top part off and saying you're going to drop this, it's going to crush the entire bottom, it's a total laughable joke. I mean, it's insane. All these scientists that have wrote these papers trying to say that this collapsed, their careers could be destroyed if the media will just allow this to get out. All these people will be laughing stock. Some of them are university teachers. I would love for the students to know that they've been lied to.
But the media would never expose it. The media is part of covering it up. I mean, that's the last thing the media...
Well, that's the thing. My stuff may never get out because other than the underground, I mean, everybody in the underground knows everything. But you got to knock people upside the head to even wake them up so they'll look at this stuff. Other than that, most of them are shocked. No way. The government would never do that. You must be nuts. Don't destroy my worldview. So here's something that I brought up on one of some like 15 or 20 shows I did with Jim Fetzer. And you can understand this. I'm going to tell you something that's going to knock your socks off and blow your audiences away. Look at one of the Twin Towers. Okay, now look at the first floor. Let's say the first floor could be constructed as a building, 208 feet by 200 feet, and then you just put a flat roof on it. It's going to be real strong. You got these big stick girders. Now let's just consider that one building. Now let's say that we're going to build another building, which we consider that building to be a floor, and we're going to put it on top of the first floor. Now, you see that the first floor can hold itself up. Anything that holds itself up has a safety factor of 1 because it can hold itself up. And if you can put another one identical to it on top of it and build it right on top of it, so you got it can hold its own weight plus one more multiple of its weight. Now it has a safety factor of 2. Now let's add 9 floors on top of that first floor. What's the safety factor then?
What are you saying? It would be 9.
Of the first floor. I'm talking about the safety factor of the first floor. How many times its weight and can it hold if you got 9 floors above it?
Wouldn't that be 9? I'm not sure.
No, it'd be 9 plus 1 itself. It holds itself up plus 9.
So now I have a safety factor. Okay.
And that doesn't mean that's where it's going to collapse. That means that it has a safety factor of at least that or more. It's not a safety factor because the safety factor is the point to where it'll collapse multiples of its own weight. All right, let's add to that first floor 109 floors. Now what's its safety factor for the first floor? Not the building, but for the first floor.
110.
It has a safety factor of 110, okay? And New York City's telling you that the building has a safety factor of 5. And I say, you guys are insane. Just look at this logically like I have. Now, nobody that I know of has looked at it in this way.
Proportion of the top of the tower that fell down upon itself. Like, it's nothing in relation to the mass of the towers. That's what your work shows so clearly.
But think of the safety factor. They're telling you this building has a safety factor of 5, which is total BS. It had to have way, way, way more than even more than skilling, because we're talking about steel. Now, as a teacher, as a physics teacher, chemistry teacher, for years and years, I participated in science projects. And the ones that I participated in was building wooden towers, balsa wood towers, like the Twin Towers, same shape, same height, proportions, very, very similar, and balsa wood bridges. And what we would do is test them after the students made them. We'd show them how you would try to use a diamond structure, an octet structure, like Buckminster Fuller used in his domes, and to get the most powerful structure. And what we found out is that a good structure could hold 4,400 times its own weight before it actually crushed.
Wow.
4,000. So the safety factor for a balsa wood bridge or tower, just like the Twin Towers, was 4,400. 4,400. Wow. Now they're trying to tell me that the Twin Towers, which is steel, awesome steel, has a safety factor of 5, and I'm just laughing, rolling on the floor. Anybody that would believe this, of course, people will believe it because they don't have any experience. They just believe whatever they're told. But not me. I already know. I'm experienced. I've been teaching this stuff for years, and I just know it's ridiculous. So you got the idea of what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. For sure. And I mean, they have their own experts who kind of parade out these other models, but completely unrealistic assumptions.
They're paid propagandists, paid liars.
Yeah.
Here's what I found out the other day. It shocked me. I went to Christopher Bolin's site, and I found out that the guy by the name of Zednik Mazant, who teaches at Northwestern University, he came out with a paper explaining the gravity-based collapses of the towers.
Oh, yeah.
And he had a paper ready to publish the next day, one day after the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
And he submitted it for publication. He sent it to a guy named Stein Stu. Stein Stu. When you hear the word Stein, what do you think of? Anybody with the name of Stein in it, what are they?
Our favorites.
Goldstein, Silverstein.
Yeah, I know.
Anybody that has the name of Stein. Now, I haven't been able to prove that he's Jewish, but he was a peer reviewer of that paper, so I just put 2 and 2 together. I said, and I also found out that Bazant is a Czech Jew. He's a Czech Jew, just like one of the guys that were handled the transaction or the purchase of the Twin Towers or the selling of it, was also a Czech Jew. There's a whole bunch of Czech Jews involved in this. So what I'm saying is that Bazant, as a Czech Jew, is basically supporting the Zionist neocon agenda. When he did his paper, it's all lies, it's false, it's bullshit.
Yeah.
Total crap.
I mean, whoever perpetrated 9/11, like, they had to have control of the media to be able to maintain the fraud and to perpetrate what they did. So,
well,
you know,
when you own all the media, Chris, when you own all the media, you also own all the journals, the scientific journals.
Yeah.
And if you want to get something, peer reviewed, you just get a few Jews on there, a few Zionists that support it.
Everybody
says, "Oh God, it's got to be right because it's peer reviewed."
Yeah.
But it's biasly peer reviewed.
Yeah.
And the whole paper is like unintelligible to anybody who isn't a graduate student using differential equations. My proposal is that anybody that wants to prove anything on the Twin Towers, you need to put it in basic high school Newtonian physics with the basic equations. The three basic equations are at least the action-reaction law, the third law, and the second law. And you put all your math, your kinetic energy, and your potential energy. It's very, very simple. Even middle school students work with this, the bright ones. But for sure, high school students can understand this from the basic math. So I'm just telling you that these papers that are getting reviewed are being reviewed by Zionists. And
yeah,
I just found that out a couple of days ago.
Who perpetrated the whole fraud, and you know, it's a complex structure to it.
They got their soldiers, they got their people all lined up, all their Zionist people, their professionals. They're in every area, the architects, the demolition people, Zionists, the peer-reviewed papers, Zionists. it's just ridiculous. They got them.
I know.
Everything's
I know.
Covered. Everything's covered all through the government, all through the cabinet. All through the military, the top generals, you name
it.
But
so many people have gone along
Zionists.
With it, too. So many people have gone along with it. It could never have been done if so many people weren't complicit. But anyway, let's go back to your vector analysis of that was all very interesting. And you also had you used the image of if you had something steel, like a hammer, and you brought it down on an anvil and hitting
right.
steel, how that would be like a rebound, and the how about talking about that a little bit and what it would have meant in terms of the tower falling down on itself?
Well, again, the visuals are very important. I like to do my shows. If we do any more shows, I would like them to be visual so that we can arrange, like, you'll have your laptop or your computer there, so that you can follow along with me, and we could talk about this much better than me trying to put this in somebody's head visually, which is not nearly as easy as, mentally, not visually. Okay, now, everybody knows from blacksmiths that pound on steel swords. They use an anvil, a steel anvil, heavy, heavy, thick steel anvil, which is basically high temperature resistant. If you take a sledgehammer, I'm not even talking about the sword, just take a sledgehammer and take it and just barely hit the anvil, and you'll see it'll start to go bump, tap, 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 tap when you hit it. And then if you hit it harder, it'll bounce a little higher. This shows you that steel is extraordinarily, extremely, extremely elastic, like a rubber ball, at least in terms a rebound. When something rebounds, a ball, you throw it against the wall, it comes back to you, it bounces. The energy is absorbed into the material, the atoms are pushed together, or they're compressed, and then the electron clouds of those atoms, they get compressed together and they repel. So in a steel ball, take a steel ball, just like a jawbreaker, and if you're on a steel floor, a nice heavy steel floor, and just drop it and see if it doesn't bounce all the way up to you. There's even some metals they have right now. If you drop it, it'll bounce higher than what you dropped it from. They're super, super metals. But steel will bounce and it'll bounce maybe 15 or 20 times before it comes to a stop. And the harder that you hit it, the harder you throw it, the higher it's going to bounce. So if you got a professional pitcher, let's say you got a Nolan Ryan, he can take that steel ball and throw it into the ground as far hard as he wants. It might jump up 100 feet.
Yeah.
Okay? There's no crushing. There's no non-elastic crush, like the government and the people that wrote them papers tell you that this is an inelastic crush down. It's total bullshit.
It wasn't inelastic. There would have been rebound, and you don't see any of that reaction. I mean, the whole building, I mean, it's dustified in a few seconds. It's so obviously not just pancaking down upon itself.
The government's lying on the gullibility, and of people who just don't understand science. Whatever they tell them, they just train to believe the government. It took me a long time, even though I saw it, and I said, wow, this is crazy. This looks so ridiculous. And I'm just like you. Somebody gave me a video called Loose Change, and I sat on that thing for almost a year until I retired, and I put that video in there. And as soon as I saw that video from the shots from underneath,
yeah,
you know, because when you saw it on the day of 9/11, you didn't see anything from below. You didn't see the bombs so easily, the explosions that are so easy to see from beneath. They show it to you from above, like from a plane or something, and the clouds are all there, and you can't really see what's going on with the explosion because the bombs are blowing out underneath and inside the dust clouds. So most of the people that saw that, for them it was convincing. But once you see Loose Change from below, you see these buildings and huge rows of explosions going out all the way out, and these pieces breaking off huge, and bombs, and you can hear all the bombs. I mean, they're going off so fast, and so many of them, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of explosions, maybe thousands and thousands.
Yeah, charges, all different charges, cutting different segments.
They're going off so fast. You got 10 seconds for all these to go off. So it almost sounds like just a roar. It's hard to distinguish. Although, if you had a recording, a really good recording, you could slow down like a video into individual frames, you could probably isolate each and every single explosion, unless they were going off exactly at the same time. That's just one thing. There's another thing I can tell you about, and that is the plasticity of heated steel. Did you want to say something, and then I'll come back to that?
Well, I do want you to talk a little bit about what things you shared about mini nukes and the photographs of Building 6 and 5. Discuss that a little bit. That was very interesting.
Okay, all right. Before I do that, let me just go. See, these are different ways to prove that the towers could not go down. Now, in order to do this, you need to have a science background. And you need to understand just basic stuff about physical properties like melting, solidification, freezing point, boiling point, molecular structure, adhesion, forces of attraction, gravity forces. If you were to take that steel, let's say that you could take all the columns, the external and the internal columns, the core columns, if you could wrap heat blankets, ceramic heat blankets from top to bottom of the columns for that particular floor, let's say floor 96 or 97, and then if you could take and heat all of them at the same time, and just watch the heat go up. What you would start to see at a certain temperature, you would see them start to get weaker and softer. And it wouldn't just collapse, but what it would be, just as like a thermoplastic, you heat a thermoplastic and you see that it starts to get softer and softer, and it doesn't just melt all at one time. It melts over a very, very wide range of temperatures because the molecules that make it up have all different sizes. If they were all the same size, they'd melt at a very particular temperature. But since they're all different sizes, they melt at a wide range, and therefore you would start to see if there's a weight on top of this piece of plastic and you're heating it, you would see it start to creep down very, very slowly. And by the time you had enough heat on it to where it would be weak enough, it would never melt. The whole top would just come down very slowly, 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 and settle down. There would be no impact whatsoever. It would just settle down at the coolest point. There would be no collision whatsoever. It would be like taking a book and very, very slowly, maybe over a 10-second period, putting it on the floor. There's no impact whatsoever. So that's what would happen with the heat. So their heat story is full of shit, too. So, I mean, yeah. I got them from every direction. It's just basic science.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard that?
Well, I mean, a number of things in your presentation were new to me.
Well, I didn't talk about that in my presentation. But I can hit this from almost any angle you could think of and prove that just with common sense, even without a picture, you know, have you ever seen a plastic that gets heated up? It doesn't melt. It gets soft.
Yeah.
And if you try to put a weight on it, it'll slowly collapse.
Yeah.
Now, if you start with it at room temperature, put a weight on it, like a heavy weight that it'll support, and then heat it, you'll see that it heats up and it'll get soft, and then it'll get softer and softer, and you'll see that, oh, it's going to start to move down. And there will never be a break. There will never be a push down. It'll just slowly, slowly descend until it hits a cooler place. It'll stop. There's no impact whatsoever. That's what would have happened with the heat in the Twin Towers, because steel
creates
like a thermal
plastic,
just like a thermal plastic. There's no crush down. There's no sudden break. There's no snap. It's all BS. The government's lying. And every scientist that's out there should be yelling and screaming that this can never happen. They're all of them. They've been teaching, whatever they are. They're a student. They should think, hey, logically, how does steel just break, you know?
Yeah,
it's for 30
just
years.
Most people won't speak out against what's being done. I mean, they're go along to get along, and they're afraid of speaking out. It's terrible because...
Once you see people getting fired for whistleblowing, that's going to shut off 95% of everybody, because most people, they just want to hold on to their job. They can't imagine being out of work, trying to move somewhere else, and because you're like a teacher might teach us in their classroom.
Yeah.
And if like in a college, especially if you have a Zionist section like BYU, BYU has a satellite school in Israel. Did you know that? In Jerusalem?
No, I didn't.
I didn't realize they had so much power and influence over Brigham Young University, where Stephen Jones taught. So that's probably why they ran him out. You had a Zionist Jewish factor very powerful at that school, at any school, and that's almost all the big-name schools. A lot of your professors are Jewish. They support Israel. And you start talking anyway. Usually try to get their people as the presidents, the universities, those big names.
Yeah.
Those are mostly, a lot of the big schools, they're Zionist.
Yeah.
And so if you do anything, you just get rid of you. You know, you're not going to be corrupting the minds of our students.
Exactly.
And they get their people in all the power places, even where I taught a whole slew of principals at these schools were Jews. They get them in the powerful positions where they control what's being taught, what's going on. And now, this might be totally new to your audience, but I was a teacher, and I taught in Dade County schools. I would love to know the exact number of principals that are Jews. It's a lot. I had two or three schools that I was at that the principals were Jews.
It's very tragic,
the multicultural bullshit.
How our
educators
Our educators have kind of deceived and they've deceived their students and really not served them. I mean, it's amazing that there's so few within the universities in other areas like political science and sociology. Like, why, you know, all of this stuff should be discussed in the universities, and instead it's exactly the opposite. So they obviously have a wide control over our university system. But I did want to bring you back, Chuck. Discuss a little bit what you had said about mini-nukes and about Building 6. Most people, right. You know, they hear, have you ever, how many buildings went down in New York? And you're supposed to be informed if you said there were three, because you know about Building 7, but there's a little bit more complication. There's Building 6.
Okay. I encourage everybody who's listening to this show to go to the site that I talked to you about, Chuck Bowen's Vancouver presentation, and look at my PowerPoints. And you will see as you go through that at your own rate. I start out with my cover page about vector forces and quantitative, but then because I didn't think I was going to be able to reach everything, get everything done, what I thought was just very important, I jumped it up to the front. I jumped it up of World Trade Center 6. Okay, what you see is a big hole, huge hole. Now, what I figured out, and as far as I know, I was the first one to do this. Now, some people have kind of picked up on it after 2 years I've done it. Judy Wood is finally noticing it. You first of all, you notice that it's empty, essentially empty. There's a few dregs down there of some things. But it's I think it's a 12-story building with two or three or four basement floors. And it's empty. And the first thing I did that was the clues that just jumped out at me was to look at the edge of this big hole. And what you find out is that there's a lot of ovals and circular all along the edge. There are ovals and circles.
Yeah, I remember that. I was struck by that.
What jumped out at me was that, and then I also looked at pictures of the inside where the walls that are cut straight upwards, vertically, like a knife went straight down through it, or like a cookie cutter went straight down all the way through the basement, all the way up through the roof, directly up. Everything is vertical, 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 and there's a bunch of circulars on the edge. So what I did was to take and the size of that circle and then multiplied those circles and filled up that whole hole with about 20 or 30 circles or ellipses. And each one of those, I told you that there's a micro nuke in it. Now, people say, well, micro nukes, and no, they're just too strong. But you can make an explosive custom-made. And once you got the technology down, you can make it as small as you want. Mm-hmm. And then if you want to blow something up, since they're so small, you can just take multiples of it, like 10, 20, or 30, whatever you need to do the job. You know, because the smaller they are, the more customized the job becomes. Any job you can do, just use multiples of it, just like the Twin Towers. You saw the floors, all them things going out, you need multiples of it. So they use multiples of those mini nukes inside to blow straight upward the columns to melt them and blow them out. But anyway, what they do, from what I'm estimating, is about 30, 34 of those mini nukes, or micro nukes, how small they are, I don't know, grapefruit or smaller. And they all blew at the same time. They blew vertically straight upwards. Mm-hmm. And they cut perfectly straight upwards. They look exactly like the Oklahoma City bombing. So I say, wow. Oklahoma City was mini nukes. Exactly the same way. Exactly the same way as World Trade Center 6, World Trade Center 5. Anywhere you see a deep hole, that's a mini nuke. You look at it, it's cut vertically straight upwards. Now, my research tells me that the directed shape charge, nuclear charges can be directed and shape charged, and they can be so directed as to be directed so thinly as to be like a spotlight or a post hole digger, straight up, like a lightning bolt, or if you take a spotlight that goes straight up, like a 20th Century Fox, those spotlights. And you put 30 of them straight up. They have a whole bunch of them together. This is my model of how those mini nukes would have all gone off straight up into the air.
The end result is you have Building 6 is this massive big hole. Now, obviously, that building wasn't destroyed by the Twin Towers falling down on top of it. It had to have been rigged with explosives. So it's
blowing upwards. Nothing inside of it. If it had collapsed, if the Twin Towers had fallen on it, You wouldn't be able to see anything. You wouldn't even be able to see the hole. It would be covered up, and there'd
exactly.
be a lot of junk on top of the building. And then somebody yeah. had to get in there and take piece by piece by piece off hundreds and hundreds of pieces. And then you write, oh, there's a hole in here. You know,
yeah.
all this stuff made a hole. So that's total nonsense.
Yeah.
Total nonsense.
Yeah. So,
you got
so
an empty
that,
hole
so this,
right below
this is,
the tower.
This is major evidence, then, that Building 6 was blown up, likely with mini nukes. And then the building beside it, was that Building 5, where part of it stayed up,
thing.
But the other half went?
Same thing happened over there. You see those
what, was it Building
there?
5?
Yeah, Building 5 had mini nukes, too, but not as many.
Yeah.
Building 6... Also on Liberty Street, that big hole, that's a mini nuke too. All those holes that you saw, anywhere you saw a big hole, that's mm-hmm. a mini nuke.
Yeah.
And if it's just one oval, it's one nuke. If you see multiple ovals on the edges, you could practically figure out how many they use just from the edges of the hole.
Yeah, that's what I was... I was really impressed by your photographs of that, like seeing Building 6, and you showed those, and you could see all the circular... patterns.
Right.
Yep.
The most impressive picture was the one made by the government in some form of like a infrared or some I can't remember the name of it. But when you see it, you'll see it looks like a cookie cutter, a deep cookie cutter that will go all the way down 12 floors and two or three floors into the basement vertically, and you see these sheer walls mm-hmm. all the way around it sheer. That indicates to you these were cut. What can cut it? You have to know. Most people wouldn't know that mini nukes are directed, shaped charges,
yeah.
and that they cut straight up.
You
can aim them anywhere you want. You want to put them through a bunker, put them on the side. It'll blow right through it, a big hole.
Mm-hmm.
You want to go down into the ground, shape it that way. You put a hole in the ground. They're shaped to go off like a flashlight.
Do you think they were used with the two major towers? Do you think that's... Well,
absolutely. I think they took the cores out.
Yeah.
But what you do is you aim...
Multiples of them.
I don't know how many they used. But
yeah.
if you're making these things small, you can use as many as you want. You can produce them, mass produce them. You could put one of those on each of the 47 columns if you wanted
yeah.
to. One on each one, directed straight upwards... Every three, four, five floors, I don't know. You could do it every floor if you want it. But probably it's going to be about every three floors because as it blows up, you saw what happened to World Trade Center 6. It took everything out, all the steel, all the floors,
yeah, underneath,
everything that was in
exactly.
there, totally out. So
yeah.
if you blow it up, you take out all the steel in the columns. They're attached to the columns, are inside the columns. And when they go off, sheesh, but we're talking about nuclear temperatures. They melt them. And they just pulverize them straight up. Every three floors, you take out the entire core that way. And you time it to the cutter charges that are on the perimeter columns. They got cutter.
Yeah.
I believe, in my opinion, I believe those art students, those 100-some-odd art students, or how many there were,
mm-hmm.
the reason they were up there is that they were doing designer puzzle cutout pieces all along the perimeter. The shaped charges underneath the material, however they were able to do it. When those things, all them cutter charges went off,
mm-hmm.
they just took them out like pieces of puzzle. You see the big sections coming off. It wasn't strictly cutter. Some of the pieces were very small, individual columns, but as you went down, the chunks got bigger and bigger. I mean, huge.
Yeah.
Huge.
They obviously use different things. I think there's no doubt of that. Yeah, they used like cutter charges, nanothermite in some places, but then there had to be something further, which is the mini nukes. We are coming down to the close of the hour. I don't know, Chuck, if you wanted to remind people again, Chuck Bolwin.
Chuck Bolwin's Vancouver. Presentation.
And I hope over the next while I can get some of your illustrations up on my site or do something. We'll try again where we can have a bit more time to prepare and such. So thank you for coming on today. Was there any final thing you wanted to share? Or
Yeah, Chris, if we do another show, if we do another show, I really prefer to do my shows where they can see my PowerPoints and you have your computer. All my shows with Jim were done that way.
Yeah.
And I think
you'll have
100 times better show. You make 100 times better impression from me with my slides, if you can see them. Now, they can go back and see them and listen to the show, but it won't be as good. So
yeah, no, that was very striking.
I want to do my PowerPoints.
Yeah.
Okay, and you have your computer.
Okay.
You'll enjoy it more, too, and you'll understand it better.
Yeah.
All right, thanks a lot for the opportunity of letting your audience find out about my material, but please, please look at my PDFs that I just told you, Chuck Baldwin's Vancouver presentation, and they all will be on YouTube, hopefully. They should have been up by now, but maybe in another week.
Yeah, that's going to be good when your presentation...
Up.
Yeah, and it may correct the problem you had at the conference, which it wasn't properly sized. Yeah.
Right.
But anyway,
well,
Chuck, thanks very much for coming on today and carrying forward with your teaching. And you had an excellent presentation, and it's just pulling things together more and more.
Okay, all you people that are listening, spread the news far and wide about the towers. Could never fall down. Thank you, Chris.
Okay, goodbye. Okay, so we're just coming down to the end of the show. I gather we lost Dee along the way. I don't know if the audience at one point heard very loud interference on your phone. I was getting it, and then all of a sudden it went silent, and Dee has a bad phone there. But anyway, so this has been another episode of Zero Point Radio Show. Please visit my site at www.zeropoint.ca. And I have a fascinating book, this 1137, God's Contracting Universe, all about 9/11 and New World Order and Agenda 21. It's an inspired and interesting book. So please, consider buying that and supporting me in my work. Okay, so we'll be back next week. We're going to have a two-hour show all on chemtrails and new initiatives in that regards. Okay, thank you, BBS. Take care, all. Goodbye.